All right, it is 12:15, 7:15 in Israel, so I think we can get started. Welcome to Rabbi Ziering again. I think this week's topic, Shemitah as a lens in Torah, is overturning rabbinic law and biblical law. Who has the power? Who has the final say in these matters? So, Bakasha, Rabbi Ziering.
Okay, so let me share my screen here. thank you, Ray Kelman. One second, here we go. Okay, so as we picked up with the topic that we were dealing with last week, which is the issue of Tosefet Shvi'it, the additional time that's added to Shemitah in anticipation of the Shemitah year, and afterwards the prohibitions on plowing and planting, even in the lead up to Shemitah. And as we briefly mentioned last week, before we launch onto the broader topics, in the Bavli at least, there are two traditions. There's the tradition of Rabbi Akiva and the tradition of Rabbi Ishmael. Rabbi Akiva believes that Tosefet Shemitah is based on a pasuk in the Torah, is based on a verse in the Torah. And on the other hand, Rabbi Ishmael believes that it is halacha l'Moshe Misinai. At least part of it is halacha l'Moshe Misinai. However, that halacha is limited and only applies in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. What I want to point to is a very puzzling passage in the Yerushalmi. And from there, get into the question of as the title says, who has the final say on biblical or rabbinic law? So if we look for a moment at the Yerushalmi here, we saw it last week, but I put it here again in number three in the bolded part. The Gemara says as follows: V'im kein lama ne'emar chorshim ad Rosh Hashanah. If in fact there is this idea of Tosefet Shvi'it, of Tosefet Shemitah that we add to Shemitah, so then why does it say that you're allowed to plow until Rosh Hashanah? Right, that's not really true. You have to stop plowing before Rosh Hashanah. And yet, here we have the halacha that you're allowed to plow all the way until Rosh Hashanah, which implies that there is no additional time to Shemitah. So Rebbe Kruspai b'shem Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Gamliel, uveit dino hitiro, b'isur shnei prakim arishonim. So the Gemara answers in the name of Rabbi Kruspai, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, that at least Shnei Prakim Arishonim, which was two time periods before Shemitah, when it was prohibited to plow and plant, Rabbi Gamliel and his court lifted the prohibitions. And nowadays, you're allowed to plant and plow all the way until Shemitah. So the Gemara then asks Rabbi Yochanan, boy, Lo chen tanina and ein beitin yachol levatel divrei beitin chavero ad she gadol mimenu bechokma uveminyan. How can you say that Rabbi Gamliel voted to lift the prohibition on planting and plowing in anticipation of Shemitah? The normal rule is that a court is not able to nullify the decree of another court unless it's greater in number and greater in wisdom. Now, what exactly wisdom means and what number means is not entirely clear, considering all Sanhedrin, all of the high courts have the same number of people at 71. And how do you gauge Chochmah? How do you gauge who's smarter? So the Rishonim have different positions. Either you figure out who the wisest, the aggregate wisdom, however you figure that out, or maybe the wisest head of the Beit Din, and Minyan might not mean how many people in the court, but how many students the people on the court have, so how widely accepted they are, or how much influence they have. But whatever it is, Rabbi Yochanan asks, how could it be that it was once prohibited to plow and plant in anticipation of Shemitah, and now it's not? How could you undo that? Normally, you're not allowed to undo that which a previous court says. So the Gemara then answers, Reb Kruspoi, B'shem Reb Yochanan, Shimbikshu lachrosh yachroshu. When they originally decreed, or something like that, they said that if you want to plow, then you can. So the Gemara says, v'yakro otam min ha-mishnah. So if the halacha has changed, so why is it still in the Mishnah? Rabbi Krispa Yishim Yochanan Shim Bikshu Lachzor Yachzoru. Because you might want to bring the halacha back. Right? So we leave it in as a possibility, but nowadays we don't. And we don't keep this law. And in fact, that's the way we paskin, that's the way we rule, that nowadays the additional periods before Shemitah don't apply. You're allowed to plant and plow up to Shemitah. Today they started sending out the guides for gardening during Shemitah of what you have to do, how you have to make sure to be ready so that when the prohibition does take effect, you'll be ready and you'll be able to keep your garden going. But the anticipatory periods do not apply. So then if you skip down, the Gemara has a few more questions. And then it has the following. Shamat Rabbi Acha b'shem Rabbi Yonatan. B'shah she'asru, when they had prohibited plowing in anticipation of Shemitah, the Mikra Samchu, they relied on a pasuk. And when they chose to permit plowing and planting in anticipation of Shemitah, they found another verse to rely on. When they wanted to prohibit it, they relied on a pasuk. As we saw last week, the pasuk that seemingly is about Shabbat, but Rabbi Kiva, at least in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, the anonymous voice says that you can't, that you have to rest from plowing and reaping, right? This includes plowing of the year before Shemitah, shunichnas l'shvit, uvikatzir shecharisho asur, ve'ezeze katzir shel shvit shuyotze lemotzei shvit. And plowing or reaping after Shemitah, that's also an extension of Shemitah. Uvishah she'tiro, when they chose not to prohibit the extended Shemitah period, Mikra Samchu, they also found a verse to rely on. Sheshet yamim ta'avod vasita kom lachtecha. Work for 6 days. Ma erev Shabbat breishit ad mutar lasot melachat shetishkachama. Just like on Friday, going into Shabbat, you're allowed to work all the way up until Shabbat. Af erev Shabbatot shanim, so too the Shabbat of years, meaning Shemitah, ad mutar lasot melachat ad shetishkachama. Okay, I'm going to pause the share for a minute and frame what we have. So we have here is the following. The Yerushalmi tells us that there was a time period at which it was prohibited to plow in anticipation of Shemitah and to reap after Shemitah. And eventually that was lifted. The Gemara asked, how could that be lifted? Isn't there a rule that a court cannot override the ruling of a previous court unless it's greater in wisdom and number? So how could Rabbi Gamliel's court come around and undo the prohibition on preparing for Shemitah and benefiting post-Shemitah from what was planted during Shemitah? So the Gemara has a few lines, and then the answer we're going to focus on. The Gemara says, don't worry about it. When it wanted to prohibit it, it relied on a pasuk. And when it wanted to permit it, it found a different pasuk. When they wanted to prohibit it, so they relied on the drasha becharisha v'katzir tishpot, that you should rest from plowing and reaping, which they understood to be an extension of not Shabbat, but of Shemitah, not the Shabbat of days, but the Shabbat of years, and not to apply to the prohibitions during Shemitah, but to apply to those that are in advance and afterwards. And when they wanted to permit it, they found a different pasuk that says work for 6 days and rest on the seventh, and comparing again Shemitah to Shabbat. And from that, we derived that just like in anticipation of Shabbat, you don't have to add, which of course is not totally clear because you are supposed to add. But so too, you don't add for Shemitah. So that is, right, that is the Yerushalmi's statement. Now, here's the problem that I want to set up. There is a position that we will see that this limitation that a court can only uproot the words of a previous court if they're greater in number and in wisdom, and otherwise we have a certain legislative stability, right? That once a law exists, it can't easily be undone. There is a strong tradition that that only applies by rabbinic law. However, this Yerushalmi calls it into question because, at least at face value, this is a biblical law. And yet, the rule is being invoked. So what we want to do is try to understand the nature of rabbinic law and the nature of biblical law such that we can understand this passage in the Yerushalmi. So here we return to the sources. Okay. So, you know what? Let me start with the Rambam, because I think this will frame the issue well. Okay? We can read this in, we can read this one in English. I have the translation here. The Rambam has the following summary of rabbinic law versus biblical law. And this is the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchot, second paragraph of Mamrim, of Rebels. He says, when using one of the principles of exegesis, the Supreme Sanhedrin derived a law through their perception of the matter and adjudicated a case accordingly. And afterwards, another court arose and they perceived another rationale on which basis they would revoke the previous ruling. They may revoke it and rule according to their perception. This is reflected by the Pasuk in Dvarim. To the judge will be in that age. Ela shofet asher yeh bayamim ahim. This indicates that a person is obligated to follow only the court in his own generation. That's halacha aleph, the first law. The second law, the following rule applies when a court issued a decree, instituted an edict, or established a custom, and this practice spread throughout the Jewish people. And another court arose and sought to nullify this original order and eliminate the original edict, decree, or custom. The later court does not have this authority unless it surpasses the original court in wisdom and in its number of adherents. So, the Rambam has the following position, which in many ways is surprising. The Rambam says that there's two types of laws. There's two functions that the Sanhedrin, the high court, has. One is in their interpretive role, right? They look at the Torah, they try to understand what the Torah says, and based on that, they figure out what's the biblical law, right? They look at the Torah says don't do malacha on Shabbat. They try to figure out what does it mean to do malacha? What does it mean to not do work? And then they tell you it means this, it means that. If a later court comes and says, you know what? I think you misread the Torah, you misread the Pesukim. The Rambam says, so then there is no problem, right? The second court is allowed to override or reinterpret the Torah in a way that's distinct from the first court, no problem, no limitations. They can interpret the Torah however they want. Then the Rambam says, but that's not true of rabbinic law. If the rabbis don't interpret the Torah, but they set up a decree, they say, I don't know, it's forbidden to take medicine on Shabbat. It is, right, it's forbidden to move things that are mukta on Shabbat. If the rabbis set up a law, so then it's actually harder to change rabbinic law than biblical law. When it comes to biblical law, all they need to do is reinterpret the Torah. If they believe that the Torah means something different than it used to, so then no problem. They can change it, no limitations. They don't need to be greater. If, however, the issue is rabbinic law, it's a rabbinic decree, so then the Rambam says, they actually are more limited in their power. When it comes to rabbinic law, the only way for them to uproot a decree is if they are greater than the first court, b'chochmah u'v'minyan, in number and in wisdom. So the first question we have to understand is, why does the Rambam seem to believe that biblical law is more flexible than rabbinic law? Right? Intuitively, we're used to believing that biblical law is stronger than rabbinic law. Biblical law is what God said. Rabbinic law is what human beings said. Important human beings. Very important human beings, but human beings. So if you'd asked me intuitively, which is harder to change, biblical law or rabbinic law, I would have said biblical law, right? The word of God is harder to change than rabbinic decrees. And yet the Rambam says it's not true, right? The Rambam says that biblical law is easy to change. All you need to change biblical law is for a later court to say, you know what? I think the first court was wrong. And then they have to offer that interpretation and that's it. That's all you need to do. But rabbinic law, even if they disagree with what the previous court said, they don't like the decree. They don't like the prohibition on against medicine on Shabbat. They think it causes too many people to suffer through Shabbat with a headache. They're not allowed to change it unless they're greater in wisdom and number. So why do you think that the Rambam believes that it's harder to change rabbinic law than biblical law? Right? Again, we normally think that biblical law is stronger. It's from God. So why is it that when the rabbis are trying to understand what God said, it's for the Rambam, it's relatively easy for them to change their mind, right? A later court just comes and said, I think it's different. But when it's rabbinic law, suddenly we say, no, you need to check all these boxes, all these formalities. You need to be wiser. You need to be, right? You need to be greater in number, right? Why is it that rabbinic law is less flexible than, okay, I have a comment here. I don't know from who. Because biblical law is always on the books, even if modified. Okay, good. So you want to, I don't know who that is, but whoever that is, you want to clarify? I think you're right. But what exactly is the difference? Right? What does it mean that biblical law is always on the books, even if modified? It just says iPad. So I don't know who said that. Okay, I'll let someone else try it. Otherwise, I'll try to tease out this comment here. It's ever, okay. And I have another comment here. The Torah itself seems to change biblical law. Okay, so that is true as well, that sometimes the Torah itself, right, seems to present things differently. The question of what is happening there is obviously much of rabbinic interpretation is trying to figure out exactly that, right? Why is it that Moshe in Dvarim presents laws differently than the rest of Torah? Is it a change? Is it a complement? Okay, good. But why is it that biblical law? So if I understand Gershon's comment correctly, you're saying, well, biblical law, we know changes. Okay. Torah Shebaal Peh gives strength to biblical law. Okay. Okay. But again, the question we need to answer here is why is it that biblical law is somehow easier to change? Meaning you could say, well, the Torah itself changes. Okay, fine. Even if that's true, so rabbinic law doesn't, meaning if God's law can change, whatever that means, right? Then why can't rabbinic law?
This is not a question of stronger in this. I mean, this doesn't change the fact of the status of how you adjudicate biblical versus rabbinic law. This is a question of maybe an analogy is between legislation and constitution. That is
okay. Good. Explain.
But the biblical law hasn't changed. The law is still there. The Torah says what the Torah says, but we now understand it differently. So you're not abrogating anything midoraita. Whereas when a court makes a decision not based on biblical law, we should think of it in our terms in the sense of like it's legislated something. A gzeira is more like legislation. And then to uproot it, you need some procedure that lets you repeal the previous legislation. But we don't have such a procedure. I mean, so the Rambam is setting up such a procedure in some sense, but he's making it very difficult to do so. But it's not at all a question of biblical law being more flexible or biblical law being weaker or stronger. It's a difference in status.
Good. So I think Richard is talking. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I think Richard's 100% right. Right. I was being a little bit deceptive, right? The issue here isn't stronger, weaker, more important, less important, right? The question is, as Richard puts it very nicely, the difference between constitution or let's say constitutional interpretation versus legislation. Right. And I think that's exactly right. Now, what does that mean? So if you think about American politics is more vicious than Canadian politics. So these things end up in the news more often. But if anyone's been following American news in the last few years, you know this is always in the news, right? There's been several new Supreme Court nominations. And every time there's a Supreme Court nomination, it's very heated. Why is it so heated? Because they're afraid that you put a new judge who is whatever, right, an originalist, whatever, on the Supreme Court, or to take the case that usually comes up in the questions, right, a judge who is not inclined to automatically accept the conclusions of Roe v. Wade, right? They're terrified that all it takes is a few judges on the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade will be overturned and abortion will not be legal in the United States. Now, why are they so afraid that that's going to happen? Without wading into politics, right? In terms of what you support, what you don't support. I don't really care. But in terms of, wait, why are they so afraid? And the reason is because in the end of the day, the issue there is one of interpreting the Constitution, right? When it comes to interpreting the Constitution, on the one hand, as Richard notes, this is the Torah. It's the Constitution. It's the most important legal text in America. But on the other hand, when a later Supreme Court comes, if they ever overturn Roe v. Wade, the reason they're doing it is not because they're making a law. They're not legislating. What they're doing is they're saying, listen, the court that decided Roe v. Wade is answerable to the Constitution. And they thought that the Constitution said abortion was legal. We are answerable to the Constitution. And we think that that's not what it means. And therefore, we're not changing the law. We're telling you that the law was always like this because the book, the text that you're answerable to always existed. We just think that you got it wrong. Interpretation, constitutional interpretation, on the one hand, yes, whatever decision the Supreme Court makes is ostensibly interpretation of the Constitution. So it's interpretation of the most important law, whatever, the important text. But at the end of the day, it's pretty easy to change because all they need to do is say the original decision was wrong. On the other hand, right, let's say that the current Senate, House, President, etc., wanted to protect abortion, not by putting judges on the Supreme Court that agreed with the decision Roe v. Wade, but they wanted to pass a constitutional amendment. So suddenly, it's not easy, right? Why is it not easy? Because that's not interpreting the law, that's creating law. And in America, to create law, you need, right, two-thirds of Congress and 75% of the states to be on board to legislate law, to change the law. And that's harder than interpreting law because you're not answerable to anybody. You're creating law. So I think Richard is 100% right. The way the Rambam thinks is that when the rabbis are acting as interpreters, the reason that it's relatively easy to change their conclusion is not because it's weaker, but it's because in the end of the day, they're not creating law. They're both making claims about what the original text to which everyone is answerable, in this case, the Torah, what does it say? You think it means X, I think it means Y. So as soon as I think it means Y, and I'm the head of the high court, and the court agrees with me, we're bound to be answerable to the text. So we just change it. Right? We just changed the practice because we think that's what the Torah always said. We're not changing anything. The Torah isn't changing. We just think that we got it wrong. But when it comes to legislation, legislation is very hard to change, right? Because in order for legislation to be stable, there needs to be a fixed procedure to make it law and a fixed procedure to make it no longer law. And that's much harder, right? That's much harder than saying you misunderstood it. That was never the law. So yes, as Richard said, this really is the difference between legislation or maybe even amendments, right? And though that analogy doesn't work so well in Torah, and on the one hand, and constitutional interpretation of existing law on the other. And I think for the Rambam, that's why biblical law, quote unquote, is more flexible. It's not that it's weaker. It's not that it's less. It's more important. But when you're acting as an interpreter, the only thing standing between you and a different position is an alternative interpretation. But when it comes to a decree, what's standing between you and a different decree is repealing legislation, which is much harder, right? Changing law is always harder than reinterpreting what the law always was. And that's what the Rambam thinks, right? That's what the Rambam believes. I see that someone else here said that most biblical law needs to be interpreted. Yes, right? Part of it is that the reason this is true is because biblical law always needs interpretation, meaning built into biblical law is this idea that there has to be interpretation. And therefore, for the Rambam, they'll say, look, there always needs to be interpretation. It's an ongoing process. So if built into it, there's interpretation. So built in, there might also be flexibility because there's flexibility of interpretation. Dr. Friedman, I see, writes here that maybe the Chachamim wanted to make their words more difficult. Now, that also might be part of it, right? That rabbinic law, in order to give it staying power, it needs some support, right? It needs a little bit of a, right, oomph to give it, you know, to give it power because, yeah, God's word doesn't need protection. Rabbinic law might need protection. That might be part of it too. So I think that that's definitely right. And I think that's how the Rambam viewed it, right? That's the Rambam's vision of law, that when we deal in the level of interpretation, what we're doing is we are responding to the Torah. And therefore, we can constantly be in conversation with it. And if one generation, the court says X, and the next generation says Y, so they just change it because they're in constant conversation with the Constitution. But when it comes to rabbinic law, there needs to be a process to formalize it into law, to create legislation. And in order for legislation to be meaningful at all, there needs to be a process for repealing it. Okay. 100%. So I think that that is the way the Rambam understands the difference between biblical law and rabbinic law, and why it is that biblical or interpretation of biblical law versus straight out rabbinic legislation. The problem is that in the Yerushalmi that we started with, that doesn't seem to be true. Because on the one hand, the Yerushalmi is functioning, at least seemingly, within the position of Rabbi Akiva, possibly, or at least within the position that adding to Shemitah is biblical, right, is biblical law, because it quotes a pasuk, right? It quotes a pasuk, b'chareish v'katzir tishpot. The idea that you're supposed to add to Shemitah is, right, it comes from the Torah itself. And yet, the Gemara invokes the rule of Ein Beidin Yachol Levatel Devrei Beidin Chaveiro Ad She'eh Godol Mimeno B'Chochma V'Minyan. Right? That the later court should not have been allowed to lift the prohibitions on preparing for Shemitah because they weren't greater than the earlier court in wisdom and in number. But according to the Rambam, that shouldn't be a problem. Because if what you're dealing with is biblical law, so then who cares, right? Biblical law, you don't need to be bigger b'chokhmah v'minyan, right? As Richard said, it's the Constitution. Reinterpret it, right? The first generation thought that the Torah meant that the prohibitions of Shemitah start early. They start in the months leading up to Shemitah. And a later court, the court of Rabbi Gamliel, thought that's not what it meant. So according to the Rambam, they should just change their mind, right? They shouldn't need to be greater in number. They shouldn't need to be greater in wisdom. They don't need any of that. All they need is to change their mind, right? Rami Gamliel just needs to get up and say the first court thought that Shemitah, you had to stop, you know, already starting at Shavuot. You had to start planting at, you had to stop planting, rather stop plowing. And we just don't think that's true, right? And yet, that's not what the Gemara says, right? That's not what the Yerushalmi says. So this leads us to come back to this rule and say, are there other ways to understand it? Is there a different way to understand it rather than this sharp difference that the Rambam has between biblical interpretation, constitutional interpretation versus legislation, the former of which is flexible and changeable, and the latter of which is not. The latter of which is more procedural and needs more steps in order to undo it. So in order to figure that out, we need to go back to the source for this whole principle. And that's the Mishnah here in Ediot. So the Mishnah in Ediot says the following. The Mishnah wants to know, why is it that in all the Mishnayot, anyone who's ever learned knows that you'll read through a Mishnah, Gemara, and not only will you have the accepted positions, but you'll have the rejected positions as well, right? Not only will you have Beit Hillel's position, you'll have Beit Shammai's position. So the Mishnah asked a very simple question. Why? Why do I care to know? In the end of the day, if you think the purpose of learning Torah is to know what to do, presumably that's in the background here of the Mishnah. If you think that what's important is to know what to do, so why do you have to know the rejected positions? Just tell me what the law is and move on. And then I'll know, for those of you who are learning Daf Yomi, I'll know how tall a sukkah has to be. 20 amot, right? No less, right? Is the smallest amount for a person to fit in the sukkah or a person plus his table, right? Or whatever the case may be. So the Mishnah says, V'lama mazkirin divrei hayach. Why do you have to include the position of the minority, the rejected position, amongst the position of the majority? When at the end of the day, we know that you follow majority rules. So the Gemara answers, She'im yir'eh beidin et divrei hayachid v'yismoch alav. So the first answer the Mishnah says from the Chachamim is as follows. Shein Beit Din Yachol Vatel Divrei Beit Din Chaverot Sheyeh Gadol Menu V'Chochma U'V'Minyan. It's so that if a court prefers the position of the individual, then it'll be there for them to rely on, because a court cannot change the ruling of a previous court, unless they're greater in number and wisdom. If they're wiser but not bigger, or larger numerically but not in wisdom, then they're not allowed to change the words because they need both qualifications. That's the position of the Chachamim. Amar Rabbi Yehuda. Yehuda says, "Im kein lama maskirin divrei yachid bein hamirubin levatala. She'im yomar adam kach ani mikubal yomar lo kedivrei yishponi shamat." Rabbi Yehuda says the exact opposite. He says, the Chachamim say the reason you quote a minority position is because it's not completely rejected. It needs to exist in case you want to rely on it later. You keep the voice alive in case someone changes their mind. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, the reason that you quote a minority position is so that when someone quotes it, you know that it's the rejected position being quoted, right? So let's take an example, right? Why is it important for us to know that Beit Shammai holds that you need to have, again, take an example from Daf Yomi, right? Why is it important for us to know that Beit Shammai says you need the person to fit into the sukkah with his table? Not because we accept it or will ever accept it, but according to Yehuda, the reason is as follows. Because let's say someone was in Daf Yomi shul, or he got Rai Kelman's Daf Yomi Dvar Torah, and he sees, oh, I see that there's a person who says that the minimum size for a sukkah is that you need to fit into your sukkah with your table. And then a few months later, right, comes Sukkot, and he's there building his minimum size sukkah, and he's trying to figure out how big the sukkah is. He said, you know, I vaguely remember someone saying that a sukkah has to be big enough that you have can fit the person and the table inside. Someone else should come along and say, listen, you're not wrong. You did hear that, but you heard that because it was the rejected position, right? You heard it because it was the rejected position. Make sure that you don't rely on that position. Because if you didn't know it was Beit Shammai, then what would happen? Someone would give shir. They would say, the size of the sukkah is like Beit Hillel, which is a smaller size than Beit Shammai. And someone else would come along and say, no, I heard that it has to be bigger. And people would say, oh, well, maybe he's right. Right? Because if you don't attribute a name to the minority position, they won't realize that the position that's being rejected was indeed rejected. Right? If all these positions are just sort of floating around, right, then you might end up with more mistakes. Right? But if everyone knows, listen, there's two positions. One person says it's forbidden. One person says it's permitted. We rule like the position that is permitted. So if you hear anybody say that it's forbidden, they're not misremembering. They're just misremembering what the final ruling is. That was such a position, but make sure you never rely on it. So the Chachamim say, again, that the reason we quote minority positions is to keep them alive. And Rabbi Yehuda says that the reason we quote minority positions is to kill them. Right? Right? To put it very simply, right? The Chachamim say the reason we quote minority positions is to keep them alive, so that if someone wants to rely on it one day, they're allowed to. And Rabbi Yehuda says the opposite. The reason that we quote minority positions is to make sure that no one will ever rely on them, and they'll know that that was that position that someone once held that no one cares about anymore. Right? That's the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Okay. So this is the source for the rule of Chachma Minyan. Because in that context, the Mishnah had said, She'im yirev beidin et divrei ha-yachid yismoch alav, she'im beidin yachol levatel divrei beidin chaverat she'yeh mimenu gadol v'chachma v'minyan. Okay, but what does that mean? Right? And in what sense does that work with the importance of minority positions? So, we already saw the Rambam. Right? We already saw the Rambam, that the Rambam will distinguish between biblical law and rabbinic law. And he'll say, listen, by rabbinic law, you always need to uproot the law with a bezdin, with a beitin, with a court that's greater in number and wisdom in order to overrule. But in biblical law, there's flexibility. And therefore, if there was a majority, and later there was, but there was a minority voice, right? The majority voice said forbidden and the minority voice said permitted. Or the majority voice said permitted and the minority voice said forbidden. And a later court comes and wants to rely on that and revive the dead position, they're allowed to. So the way the Rambam will read this Mishnah is that there's two things going on here. Why do we mention the minority position in biblical law? And why do we mention it in rabbinic law? We mention in rabbinic law, we mentioned in biblical law, in order for a later court to know that that was once raised and not accepted, but maybe the later court will want to accept it. That's point one. Point two is if they legislate something, then it's not so easy. They can't just change their mind and rely on what used to be the minority position and now make it the majority position. If it's rabbinic law, they need a vote of a court that's greater in wisdom and a number. That's the way the Rambam presumably will read this Mishnah. The problem is that's not what it sounds like at all, right? When you actually look at the Mishnah carefully, that's not what it sounds like, right? Because the Mishnah makes no distinction between rabbinic law and biblical law, right? It just says, why do we mention minority positions? Chachamim, to keep them alive. Rabbi Yehuda, to kill them. And somehow in the middle of that, the Mishnah throws in this rule that in order for a later court to undo the position of a court, you need to be greater in number and in wisdom. So are there other possibilities on how to understand this Mishnah, and what will that tell us about law? So as I mentioned, in the Yerushalmi seems to invoke the principle when we're dealing with biblical law. And in fact, I won't read it all inside, but if you see here, I gave you in six, in Reb Chaim Kanievsky, in his, they put together all of his comments on Shvi'it from all of his writings, and he is a very prolific author. And they organized it by Mishnah on Shvi'it. So this passage is quoted in the Derech Emunah on the Mishnah, but originally it's from a book he wrote, Nachal Eitan, which is a like 400-page book just on the mitzvah of Egla Arufa, of the breaking the back of the, killing the animal from the back of the neck when you find a murdered body and don't know who murdered him. So he wrote an entire book on that topic. It makes me feel very inferior. He wrote it, it's like this unbelievably encyclopedic work on an obscure topic that he wrote when he was like 20. But okay. But he, in fact, reads this and he says that, yeah, the key word here in the Yerushalmi is samchu. Sorry. Reb Chaim Kanievsky, right, says, listen, it's, right, it says samchu. Now, sometimes, it's only next week, samchu means rabbinic law that we attach to a pasuk, but it's really rabbinic. But Reb Chaim Kanievsky says, no. Here, it's clear from context that samchu doesn't mean rabbinic. It means biblical. Right? It means biblical. Right? We're talking about the drasha. We're talking about the exegesis from the Torah that says that adding to Shemitah is straight from the Torah. It's from a pasuk. Becharish v'katzir tishbo. And what happened? So, when they forbade it, they read the pasuk one way. And when they permitted it, they read it a different way. Now, this is the problem. According to the Rambam, and if this was all biblical law to begin with, or if this was all biblical law to begin with, and it was just a question of interpretation, then why did the Gemara say that Rabbi Gamliel wasn't allowed to do it? Why did the Gemara say Rabbi Gamliel wasn't allowed to do it unless he was greater in number and in wisdom? Right? According to the Rambam, that's just constitutional interpretation. You don't need greater wisdom. You just got to do it. But if this is biblical, so what do you do? So one possibility is to say that's really the answer, right? That the Gemara assumed in its earlier stages that it was rabbinic, and that's why it needed the later court of Rabbi Gamliel to be greater than the earlier court. And then the Gemara's answer is no. It's biblical. Don't worry about it. You thought it was rabbinic, and therefore, right, that the extensions of Shemitah were rabbinic, and therefore you need a greater court to uproot it. Nah, that's not how this works. That's not what's going on. It's biblical. And since it's biblical, all you need to do is reinterpret, right? So one way to bring the Yerushalmi is that the question assumed that adding to Shemitah was rabbinic and therefore had all the limitations, as the Rambam notes. And its answer was, no, it's biblical. And if it's biblical, so an earlier court thought that the Torah tells you you should extend Shemitah out towards Shavuot, and the later court said, no, you shouldn't. But what I discovered when going through this Yerushalmi is that there's really many, many other views. So let me at least get through one of them. And this is a fascinating, fascinating piece by Rav Kook in Igrot HaRe'iyah. He says it in several places. I just gave you. And he says, no, you know what? That's not how this works. Even in biblical law, it's not true, like Richard said before, that it's just subject to interpretation. It's not true. It's not like, oh, the Torah said something. If the court changes its mind, it understands it differently. So now all they got to do is reinterpret it. It doesn't work that way. There's different levels of biblical interpretation. And this is what he says. Amnam darki lefareshet ha-mishnah de'iduyot perek alef mishnah. This is how I understand. Lama mazkirin divrei yachid ben amirubin. Right? The Mishnah said, why do you bother quoting a minority position? Answer, Shem Yireh Beit Din Divrei Amirubin V'Yismoch Alav. She'ein Beit Din Yachol Avatel Divrei Beit Din Chaveru Ad She'yemin Gadol Mimenu Chochma V'Minyan. So the Mishnah had said, so that if you want to rely on the minority position, you can. And you can only do that if you're greater in wisdom than the previous court. So then he says, V'nir'in advarim dvarim sheshanu lo chachamim bazeh klal gadol b'sidrei hora'a l'dorot. And I'll just throw out, by the way, parenthetically, that Rav Kook says this in very short paragraphs, but if you, the person who I found who most extensively explores this is, he's very famous in very specific circles, but otherwise not very well known, is Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who was the rabbi of Hoboken back in the day. So in Malki Bakodesh, he has many, many, many pages where he comes to the same conclusion as Rav Kook. This is discussed in an extensive article on Rav Hirschenson's theory of rabbinic law in the book Bein Samchut L'Autonomia, between authority and, right, or heteronomy and autonomy in rabbinic law. There's an article there about Rav Hirschenson. And this is explored at length there. But Rav Kook says very simply, he says, listen, Nirina Dvarim Shishanula Chachamim Bazek Klal Gadol B'Sidrei Hora Aludoro. This is a critical way of understanding the way halacha works. Sha'af al pi shechiluk gadol yesh ben haskamotu gzeirot lahorot shel dinim hayotzim midarkei alimud v'adrashot. It's true. There's a big difference between rabbinic law and biblical interpretation. Kim mevor b'divrei Rambam, like the Rambam said. But not exactly like the Rambam. And this is what he says. Aval kan chidshu lanu ha-mishnah. When do we say that you're allowed to reinterpret biblical law? Not always. Lo ne'emar ki im ka'asher huchra azad davar al pi harov v'mi'ut. That's only if it was minority and majority. Val kol panim yacharayim ninsa shedato lo iskim al zeh. But there was a vocal minority. Then a later court can come and revive a minority position. That's when we say, go to the sages of your time. Just because it used to be majority one way, minority a different way, that doesn't bind a later majority. But then he says, "Avalim haitaha skamalo ra'ahazot bibeidin agadol al pi da'at kulam." But if it was unanimous, as afal pisha davar ba biderach shelimud drasha, then I don't care if it's legislation. I don't care if it's interpretation. Nikbaaz halacha zo ki ilu haitaha skamash shel takana. Then, even though it's biblical law, it's as unchanging as legislation. Shekvar chal aleha hadin she'ein beidin yachol levatel divrei beidin chavero el imken gadol mimenu b'chochma v'inyan. And then the same rule applies. V'zohi kavanat ha-mishnah kipshuta. And this is how you read the Mishnah. Lama maskirin divrei achid ben arubin? Why do you keep the minority voice alive? Ho'ol vein alachay l'kedev ha-mirubin v'zehu v'vaday noheg gam berov dini Torah. He said, it's true that we follow the majority. But if there was once a minority voice, then if a later court comes, they can change their mind. Then there's a takana. Then it's a decree. And it's no worse than a rabbinic decree. And Rav Kook says something fascinating. He says, there's three levels. It's not just biblical law and legislation. Biblical interpretation, flexible, because you just got to change the way you understand the Torah. Rabbinic law, decrees, hard to change because they're formalized. That's what gives them staying power. Rav Kook says there's three levels. Unanimous biblical interpretation. Biblical interpretation that's subject to dispute. And rabbinic legislation. It says, listen, everything we said about rabbinic legislation is true. Legislation is hard to change. It's just the way it is. You want to change legislation? You got to tick off all the boxes. You got to be smarter. You've got to have a greater number. Then you can do it. But biblical law, it's not so simple. There's two types. There's something where, look, there's a dispute. So, generation one, 40, 31, right? Majority ruled forbidden, minority ruled permitted. So then, for practical purposes, yes, we rely on the majority position. But the minority position isn't dead. So if a later court, it goes 40-31 the other way, so then you switch it. But unanimous interpretation is different. There's a certain type of biblical law that's so powerful because everyone agreed on it that nothing can change it short of the equivalent of a legislation. And I'll give you an, I see there's a few comments, but let me give you, going back to our American law example, right? Just because this became a heated moment in the Coney Barrett hearings, right? If anyone watched them, right? Several people challenged her on this in-between category called super precedent, right? The idea that there's certain types of decisions that they're not legislation, they're not part of the Constitution, but in the other, they're just interpretation of the Constitution. So in principle, you should be allowed to change it simply, right? The Supreme Court to be allowed to change it simply by changing its mind. But she believes that there's something called super precedent, that sometimes the interpretation of the Constitution has been so unchallenged by generations of courts that even though in principle it shouldn't be different than any other interpretation of the Constitution, in practice it is, because unanimity, right, when everyone agrees, then that alone gives it power. And that's Rav Kook's argument, that there's different types of biblical law. Rabbinic law, you're right, it's formally introduced, it needs to be formally repealed. But biblical law, it depends. If it's a dispute, so then it's flexible. Then one generation can side with one position. The next generation, the numbers can shift, right? It takes a few extra people in the Sanhedrin who think differently, and the votes will come in differently. But if it's unanimous, that shows something about it. It's some super interpretation. And that super interpretation can't just be changed by a simple interpretive move. It needs something greater, because that shows that it has something special to it, right? Unanimity, the fact that the court can come to and 100% can say the same thing, that's special, right? That shows you that this is not mere interpretation. Okay, I see I have, there's a few comments here, one second. Okay, I see that, right? Kelman said, for people who want to understand Egla Arufa, which we mentioned quickly, Dr. Lakshin mentioned it yesterday. Okay. Let me just go back. There's a question here. Okay. There's a question here. How did all this work? I heard that, but it was the rejected position with Amcha pre-printing this. Okay. I see. Right. How could it be, going back to what we said before, right? How could it be that someone could hear the minority position and get confused? So it's, I don't know, right? It's not necessarily just the lady who would have heard the position, right? It could be that it's the courts. It could be someone in the Beit Midrash. It could be anybody. Aren't there cases where if a Beit Din actually gives unanimous? Yes. There is one case, not in terms of legislation or biblical law. The one case in which unanimity is a weakness rather than a strength is capital punishment. right? In capital punishment, it's different. In capital punishment, the halacha is that if the majority of the court, by two, thinks that someone is guilty, so let's say it's 13 to 10 on a court of 23, so that's fine. Then you put the person to death. But if it's 23-0, you don't put him to death. And the reason is because definitional to the idea of a court that's judging capital punishment is that they have to try to find room, right? They need to try to save the defendant. And if they don't, there's something lacking in the court itself. So yes, there is one case in which unanimity is actually weaker. And that's because we don't want unanimity in a capital case, right? We want to fight because of our opposition to the death penalty, right? It exists, but we don't like implementing it. In that case, we don't want unanimity. Yes. Okay, I see we have 4 minutes. So just to summarize what we've seen, right? What we have here is two very different views of what exactly is happening and what does it mean to have the final word in Torah. According to the straight read of the Rambam, there is no such thing as there shouldn't be a final word in biblical interpretation. It should be a constant conversation with the Torah. And if one generation thinks it's forbidden and the next thinks it's permitted and the next thing's forbidden, so then that's okay because they're allowed to and they should be in conversation with the Torah. Why that's not true nowadays is something we touched on last week, right? Why is it that despite the fact that when it comes to biblical law, we should always be in conversation with it, we treat the Bavli as binding even if we disagree or don't understand it. And that's why the Kesef Mishnah on this halach actually jumps in to say, well, what's going on? Unfortunately, we don't have time right now to go back to that and review it from last week, but you can look back at the sources from last week. But the Rambam's idea, as Richard said before, is very simple. Biblical law, we're constantly in conversation with the Constitution, the Jewish people. All it takes to change is interpretation. When it comes to rabbinic law, it's legislation. Legislation is harder to institute and harder to undo. That's just the way legislation works. Rav Kook comes along and says that's not the way it works. Biblical law sometimes is flexible if there was a majority and minority, because then it was always part of the conversation. It was just the one that happened to lose out. But there are certain types of biblical interpretations that are unanimous. They're stronger. And in those cases, it's as if it was legislated. In order to undo it, you actually do need to be greater in number and wisdom because there's something special about unanimity. I will note we don't have time, but other mefarshim, other commentaries seem to think that every time there's biblical interpretation, you always need to be greater in Chachma Minyan, and they go even farther in this direction. And I gave you as an example, Mechad Shlomo seems to go in this direction. And just to bring us back to where we started, for the local question, right, what comes down to is what's going on here in Tosefet Shvi'it and the addition to Shemitah, right? Presumably for the Rambam, what you're going to have to say in the Yerushalmi is that the question was, aren't these additional times in Shemitah rabbinic? And therefore, once they're decreed, they can't be undone unless you're greater in wisdom and number. And the answer, if Rav Chaim Kanievsky is right, might be, yeah, but it's really biblical. And since biblical law is more flexible in that sense, and that's why we were able to change it. And nowadays we don't keep Tosefet Shvi'it. But for Rav Kook, there's a whole host of possibilities that are open once you realize that these rules are in play, not only on the rabbinic plane, but there are certain types of biblical law that are actually harder to change. Then we have a host of new possibilities in terms of understanding this. Another one of which we will return to next week, exploring what I called, I think, the gray area between biblical and rabbinic law, the world of asmachta. I see I have one question here. I'll take the one last question, and then we are out of time. So Norman says, Rav Kook seemed optimistic that his Sanhedrin was revived. It could achieve great things regarding sacrifices. Could his Sanhedrin today be deemed greater in wisdom than those of the past? That's a good question. Presumably, anyone who thinks that the Sanhedrin one day will change the laws of the Talmud must think that, yes, we can be greater than the sage of the Talmud. We mentioned last week, Shmuel David Glasner, the Doravi, he definitely thinks that. He thinks that one day we'll have a Sanhedrin and we'll be able to change the law. Presumably, he thinks that it's possible. But this comes down to the often asked question, do we really believe in Yiridat HaDorot, this like inevitable descent of greatness in generations, or do we think that that's not true? Presumably, and you know, Professor Schneer Lyman has an excellent article on this, that it's not that simple. It's more complicated. There's a little bit of truth in both in the belief that the earlier generations were greater and in the fact that we can achieve great things that they can't, based on often the mashal of dwarves on the shoulders of giants. But that will have to be a topic for another time. Okay, right, Kelman, I'm a minute over, so.
Okay, it's okay to go 2-3 minutes, 5 minutes over. That's it for a question. By the way, I think Yisrael Tashma also has an excellent article on Halakha Kibatrai, where he talks about that also, that idea.
He does. I think that's also in that same book. That book is a collection of different articles.
Ben correct. Samchut,
it's L'Autonomia.
I have it in English. Interesting. I have his 4 volumes in Hebrew, and that book I have in English. It's about 20 essays of his. I think mainly Hebrew. You know what I'm talking about. I know.
So this one I didn't know about. This is a collection of different authors, right? It's Tashma and Blidstein and Lawrence Kaplan.
What's printed in? I don't know that. What is printed in?
What's that book called? It is called, let me stop share. I'll get it for you. It was printed like 25 years ago or something like that, I think. Bein Samchut L'Autonomia.
Did you get to the question, unless I missed it, about why, if it's unanimous in a capital case, the person goes free? Sort of.
We did mention it. And again, I think that there.
Okay, I'm
it was put out by the Kibbutz Poelim. I put it over here. Right. So there it's interesting, right? The reason that, right, just review, we have one unique case where this is not true, right? When it comes to capital punishment, the rule is, as we said, the majority of rules by a majority of 2, at least, that, so let's say 23 to 10, that someone was Mechal Shabbat and has to be put to death, or was a murderer and has to be put to death, or was an idolater and has to be put it to death. If it's 23-0, then you don't. The reason is, the pasuk says, v'hitzilu ha'eda, because it says you have to save him. And the way I heard it once, I think maybe from Rav Schechter, I know he has an article on v'hitzilu ha'eda, so maybe it's from Rav Schechter's article, but I'm not sure, is that definitional to a course, definitional to a court, is that it needs to be able to see the other side and try to save someone, right? If they don't, right, specifically because of our opposition to the death penalty, if they can't even find, when they stretch their imagination, a single way to justify that someone should get off, then they're lacking in their very definition of a court, right? They're too, I don't know, gung-ho on killing people, right? If you can't eke out even one voice, right, it's like it's like 12 Angry Men, right? If there's a single voice, right, that means you gave it a shot, and you could switch it all the other way. But if there wasn't a single voice, right, then you've already decided before, right? Before the person really had a shot. There needs to be that standout, right? That who says no, who stands against to say that this was a fair case. But that is really a unique situation because of just the uniqueness of the death penalty. Now, yes, what if it's an simple open and shut case? That gets complicated, right? Because there is one, right? The one obvious case that Gemara gets to is what happens if the murder happened in front of the court, right? And all 23 judges saw it, right? Yes, you can come up with situations like that. What can you do, right?
I always thought that the 23 was only when they had the discussion. In other words, when the Beit Din went to discuss it, you had to have people saying he's innocent. But maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not 100% sure on the actual vote that 23.
Right, so that's part of the question, right? Is it that they need to vote that way, or it needs to be that someone needs to fight for it? Parameters of it are
okay.
But that's in its right. That's in the court's third role, right? That's some of the complexities. The courts in the Torah function in three roles, right? As the legislators, interpreters, and the judicial branch, right? Meaning they're the Supreme Court, right? They function like the Supreme Court, like your regular run-of-the-mill courts, right? And like Parliament or Congress. So, right. So in in the legislative role and in their interpretive role, that's one thing. In their judicial role, it's yet another. So, and yes, someone said if they're witnesses, they should be invalid as judges. That's in fact what the Gemara tries to figure out. Yes, that is the context of the Gemara's question. Is wait a second, aid nasadayan or aid nasadayan? Can a witness become a judge or not? So, whoever iPad is, that is exactly what the Gemara says.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. Look forward to seeing you next week and have a meaningful Tisha B'Av.
Thank you. You too. Shalom,
of course, as
easy and meaningful fast. How did the medical ethics conference go?
It was very nice. I think it was very good. Yes. Yeah. It was very. It's good stuff. Medical conference. It's Gadolei Hador come. It was very nice. So
what programming do you have for coming up for Tisha B'Av?
Tisha B'Av, we have an 8-hour program from 11 a.m. You want to hear the whole thing? Let's see if I know it off by heart. Shuli Mishkin at 11 o'clock, Menachem Liebtag at 12, Chaim Strachler at 1, I'm at 2, Tamar Spitz at 3, Moshe Sokolov at 4, Natty Helpgott at 5, and Jeffrey Glickman, who is a filmmaker in Toronto. Maybe you know him. I don't know him, but he's a filmmaker in Toronto, will be speaking at 6 o'clock. So that's 8 hours of learning on Tisha B'Av. I said anybody comes to 8 hours.
All on Zoom or in person?
All on Zoom. We're in Toronto. What do you mean in person? That's true. We shows can open up a little now. We have a little bit of open now, but it's all on Zoom. It's all on Zoom. And I said anybody who comes to all 8 classes, send me an email. We'll send them an Uber Eats so they can break the fast. If they come for 8 hours, don't forget to mention last year's program. What on Tisha B'Av, JME, Medical Ethics. Yeah, this is, I think, the before I started Torah Motion, this is how I got started in the business, if you want to call it that. When I organized the Tisha B'Av program in 1989 in Toronto, I had just come back to Toronto from my days in New York, and there was the city with zero. There was absolutely nothing going on in Tisha B'Av. And I organized the first program in Clapton Park. And that's a long time ago. Okay. And this evening, before Tisha B'Av, it's on Tim YouTube, sure. Everything's a recording. We have over 2,000 recordings now on the website. Our webmaster emailed us that it's getting crowded and he had to do some technical stuff. Don't ask me, but he said everything seems working fine. We have too much material on the website, but 600 classes on Zoom since last March or so, and about 1,400 before. And if only we had relied on a Shabbos Goy to tape all our Shabbos classes, we'd have thousands more. But no, what can we do? We did not go that route. And this evening at 8:30, Rachel Slutsky, you know her, Rabbi? You know who she is? She's at Harvard, finishing up her PhD. I figured maybe you'd know her.
Oh, Renz. She's Renz. Rachel Renz.
I don't
Renz
know
her. Slutsky.
I don't know her maiden name. She's the Isaac.
Yeah. She just got a job at Seton Hall.
Correct. She just got a job at Seton
Hall. Yeah. Rachel Ren Slotsky. She's great. Yeah. She's old friends of Aaron Mike.
I figure she's in your sort of, league.
We were in Rabbi Clapper's together one summer.
Okay. Very nice. I only know her. I don't really know her. The little I know her is only, a Slotsky. So, Vakasha, thank you. But that's at 8:30 or 3:30 in Israel for those who can't sleep. Lori Novick, by the way, was on our panel at Medical Ethics.
Yes, I saw that.
It began at 8 o'clock, and I only asked her because I have a nice relationship with her, and I knew she'd say yes, and she did say yes. And
8 o'clock your time, so 3 in the morning.
8 o'clock our time at night, 3 in the morning, from 3 to 4:30 in the morning. And
I've done that before. I'm giving a share tonight, which will go quite late, but not quite that late.
Yeah, it's the first time I've done something like that. I'm not so mean usually, but it worked out very well. Worked out very nice.
No, I'm giving for a clapper tonight, but that starts at 3:30.
Oh, 3:30. Okay, that's
Well, it's a 3-hour slot. So.
Oh, it's a 3-hour slot. That's a bigger deal.
I don't know how much I'll go. We'll see.
Okay. Anyways, tomorrow, my Shir and Perkei Avot at 9:30 for those that would like to join us. That'd be great. And okay, we'll see you. Everybody be well. Have
Shabbat Shalom. And I'll see you next week.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Bye-bye.